Okay, hello. My name is Ebony Love, and today is Wednesday, March 1st, 2017. I'm sitting here in Walker Hall interviewing as part of the SPOP Spring 2017 cohort on the topic of African American and Latino histories here at the University of Florida. I want to first start off by thanking you for taking the time to interview with me and talk about the student population here. And if you don't mind, may you please introduce yourself by stating your name and your position here at UF.
My name is Dr. Vincent Adjumo. I am a lecturer in the African American Studies program at the University of Florida.
Okay, so we're going to start off with the easy questions first. The first one that I'm going to ask you is, where did you grow up and what was your home life like?
I grew up in Tampa, Florida. Started off as, you know, dual parent household. Then a single parent household when I was 6 years old. The household was composed of my mom and my sister, but we saw our father pretty regularly, I would say. So he was very involved in our lives. He remarried, and so my stepmother, who I consider a mom as well, very part of our lives, really helped us get to the next level as far as educationally and professionally. So, but the day-to-day home life, it was very interesting because growing up single-parent home, household, in a predominantly black neighborhood, the neighborhood is considered one of the lowest income neighborhoods in Tampa, mm-hmm. East side of Tampa. Walking to school every day, sometimes being bullied as especially elementary school, and then we also went to the Boys and Girls Club. So, you know, it was a very interesting day to day home life. And then once I got to high school, because our neighborhood was divided, some of us went to different high schools throughout Tampa, and so in high school I first started going to a Latino-dominated high school, and then my junior year, they opened up a high school in my neighborhood called Middleton High School. So that was a predominantly black high school again. And, it was interesting because growing up in a single-parent home, you know, and being a black male, you know, you're expected to exhibit certain behaviors and, you know, certain, you know, I did, you know, some things, but on a lot of things, I was very different from as far as my demeanor and my focus. I was very different from a lot of my peers and because I had a gift intellectually, and I'm not saying that they didn't either, because obviously they did, but we just chose different paths on how to channel it. And so it made for a very interesting experience. My sister, you know, she a very smart individual as well. She's now an engineer. I'm a, you know, full-time faculty member at the University of Florida. So obviously we've done well for ourselves. But growing up, it was hard times, but hard times are some of the best times. And, you know, that's where we developed character. Being in that environment, you know, I remember when I went to Middleton High School, every day we would walk home from school and there would always be a fight. I mean, it got bad. It got to the point where there was helicopters hovering over the neighborhood because mm-hmm. there was all these fights that were going on. And so being in that type of environment, I almost felt like being in the military zone almost. I mean, police cars everywhere every time school let out because there was a threat of shootouts. So being in that type of environment, you know, there were programs that I enrolled in, you know, playing on a basketball team. Or there was a specific one called Computer Mentors where, you know, I learned how to build and repair computers. So that type of, those type of after-school programs were important for me to stay out of trouble and to not be part of what is typically expected from someone who went to Middleton High School. So home life growing up, it was, you know, yeah, I would say it's typical of an American black family, you know, being, you know, my parents were divorced, so single mother, you know, two children, mom worked long hours, you know, went to the Boys and Girls Club to make up for, you know, activities. So I would say it was a typical life for an African American in this day and age, at least. And I'm thankful for it.
You mentioned different programs after school and the Boys and Girls Club. And when I think of my own experiences, because I have the same story, parents divorced, single mother household, everything like that. A lot of times I think of those experiences that link to like a primary, secondary educational experience that links to basically how I formed my future career. Can you think of any like one experience or like one memory that helped formulate maybe either choosing a college, choosing a career path or anything like that?
Well, definitely. There was this other program it was actually through computer mentors that, you know, they were looking for people to go to Tallahassee for this program called Boy State. And in Boy State, you know, in at first I didn't know what it was, but it was basically a program in which, you know, you go to Tallahassee for a week, you stay on campus at Florida State University, you stay in the dorms for a week, and you basically learn how government works. And they create this mythological state called Boy State, in which individuals can run for a House and Senate and governor, et cetera, et cetera. So that had a tremendous impact as far as me eventually wanting to do government. And well, first of all, me wanting to go to Florida State, because when I went to Florida State that summer, actually was when I first saw Phi Beta Sigma. And, you know, we went to the bowling alley, and I remember they were serving ice cream, and, you know, they played their Stroll song. And I was like, wow, what is this? Like, you know, so being a junior in high school, I was 16 at the time, actually. So being a junior in high school, like, that really motivated me even more, because I told myself, I was like, I'm going to get here. Like, I don't know what it's going to take, but I got to get to this campus. So, you know, that pushed me harder to work harder in my studies. And, you know, so senior year came that really motivated me and to do well in my study. So that Boy State experience was my first real, because before that, I would have my mindset on being like a computer engineer, because I was working with computers through computer mentors, and my curriculum, my high school curriculum was centered on technology. So I had in my head, I was just gonna do that. But that Boy State experience really changed the trajectory of what I wanted to do. So even though I went to Florida State and I still did business at first, I did management information systems, which is technology. I did human resource management and management. You know, I always had in my head that I wanted to some way get into politics in some way, shape, or form. Not necessarily be the front man in politics, but, you know, still have something to do with it. So in Florida State, I also interned at the Capitol. So that was another trigger. Boom. Then when I graduated from college and then I went on to work at Strayer, I chose public administration, my master's in public administration degree, because I wanted to kind of get a little bit more closer to politics. So I did that, and then I ended up getting my second master's and PhD in political science when I came to the University of Florida. So that experience at Boy State was the initial trigger.
Okay. So my understanding is, first, your childhood, you were single parent household, but your father was very involved and your mother as well. And that's where you solidified your educational philosophy a little bit. Mm-hmm. Was it your stepmother or was it like, how exactly does that educational philosophy, where does it come from?
My mom solidified the base. Mm-hmm. My dad solidified the work ethic. And my stepmom solidified the actual steps that need to be taken in order to get to college, So my stepmom, she was very connected in Tampa. Because, my dad is not from Tampa. My dad is from Nigeria. So, and my mom is not from Tampa. My mom is from Fort Pierce, Florida, which is not too far from Miami. So both of my parents, my mom and my dad, they're not from Tampa. So they didn't, they obviously they're smart people. They both have college, they're both college educated. My dad, he has his master's degree. So they're both college educated and smart, but it was my stepmom who really provided the practical knowledge on how to not only go to college, but get funding for school and like the intricacies on what I need to do with respect to taking the SAT. My stepmom also made sure that we went to church every Saturday because they had a SAT practice program. And that did tremendous wonders. I mean, because I remember when I first took the SAT, I got an 840 on it. And that was not enough to even sniff school. So going to that free, those free practice study sessions with the church, it improved my score enough for me to get in FSU. Not only that, but to also get the scholarships that I needed to maintain that FSU. So the church, through my stepmom, her knowing about what exactly I need to do to get to where I need to go, that's priceless. Like, that's priceless. Like, because a lot of these children I see, they're smart, but they don't have that, environment in the home or somebody that's around them or can touch them 24/7. That knows exactly what they need to do to get to where they need to go. And that's invaluable. That is invaluable.
So I'm starting to see a pattern. It's the different programs that were available to you that kind of helped get, pave the way. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to switch gears a little bit and fast forward to your college career. Yeah. So you mentioned as part of Boy State, you saw Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity Incorporated for the first time. Mm-hmm. I personally attended your presentation on our Black Greek Letter Organization still mm-hmm. relevant. Can you briefly explain what a Black Greek Letter Organization is and what they mean to college campuses and specifically predominantly white institutions?
Well, a Black Greek Letter Organization is an organization in which, whether it's a fraternity or sorority, you have a group of students on campus who come together for a common cause to, ensure that issues pertaining to African Americans, because these are African American and Greek Letter organizations, to ensure that, not only that there is an awareness of it on campus, but there's also a celebration of it, because they are also at its core, social organizations, but not only in the university, but also in the community as well, that there is a celebration of African American culture. And with that responsibility comes the another responsibility in which you're expected to, or it comes to the expectation of being a student leader. Mm-hmm. And so the point of a Greek Letter organization is not necessarily to be the speaker of all Black people at a PWI. That's not the point. But the point is for Black Greek Letter organizations to be, a leader in some capacity, whether it's on paper or just in personality. To be a voice and a guiding light, and to set the tone, for persons of color on campus, and to celebrate African-American culture, whether that's through stepping, whether that's through strolling, whether that's through chanting, whether that's through programming, whether that's through community service. So.
Okay, my follow-up question is, do you belong to a Black Greek Letter organization?
Yes, I was initiated into the Mu Epsilon chapter of Phi Beta Sigma at Florida State University, spring 2006. So yes, I am.
Okay. And then since you are a part of one, how did your chapter influence your campus when you attended FSU?
My chapter really didn't have a strong influence on campus per se. My chapter was not, you know, we were not like student government. Mm-hmm. You know, we were not BSU. We were not NAACP. You know, so we, as far as the politics of campus, we were not influential at all, I would say. But where we did influence campus, or, you know, the campus, was our programming. I would say we were probably the strongest programmers on campus. And we were very strong as far as people being able to touch the grease, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we didn't have snobbish attitudes, and we didn't have an attitude of separation. We had an attitude of inclusion, no matter what. And we had an attitude of, you know, because even when I was not a Phi Beta Sigma man, when I was just a active student on campus, before I was initiated, you know, I felt like I was one of the fraternity members without actually being in a fraternity. I think that's something that's missing today with our organizations, is that we've become so, or maybe it's just a Phi Beta Sigma characteristic, I don't know, but we've become so, oh, I'm this, so I, you know, I can't be a part of that, you know what I'm saying? You know, I think that's become a detriment, and in part, and especially on PWIs, because unfortunately administration, because you're Greek, you're also, not only are you expected to be a leader as far as among the Black community, but also administration pays attention to you a little bit more because of their Greek system or whatnot. And because of that, sometimes, you know, the detriment of it could be that administration gets to a few of the Greek letter individuals that are Black Greek Letter organization, Greek Letter individuals, and then try to influence them to not do something or to not act in the best interest of the at-large African-American community. And so so with us, when I was at Florida State, my chapter, we were not very big in politics because we felt that, you know, it was a very big game that we didn't want to play. We felt like we didn't have time to play the game, because we wanted to make sure that our, you know, we was busy preparing for step shows, and we was the best steppers on campus. We won step shows, and we were constantly doing community service for two. And our program, we was always thinking of innovative ways to program and to be a part of the fabric of campus in that capacity. So
when you talk about programming with your fraternity, do you think that when you were doing that, how do you think that you impacted student lives on campus?
Oh man, I mean, the impact was incredible. I mean, just me thinking about it, like right now, like for one, we had this program called Sleep Out for the Homeless, and you know, in which we would actually brave the cold. We did it in like December. Like, we didn't do it in the summer. Like, we did it in the cold of the cold. So being able to do a programming like that and have a bunch of not only students donating canned goods and non-perishable items, but also getting Habitat for Humanity on board and getting Red Cross on board and all these other community organizations on board, you know, that had an impact on my life. You know what I'm saying? Being able to see that, you know, just tell people that, hey, this is what we're doing, something positive. And people wanting to be a part of that by just simply donating, you know. And then we actually had people from those organizations come out and they would give talks on, you know, the homelessness in America. They would give facts and figures. And we actually have homeless people actually come on campus and sleep among us. And we would feed them food and we would give food to the students who came. We gave free food. You know, almost like a Black Panther initiative now. I mean, Huey P. Newton was obviously a Phi Beta Sigma man. So, you know, so that's one of the another program we did was we did HIV/AIDS block party, in which, again, we had free HIV/AIDS testing. And at the same time, we had a block party, you know, to celebrate knowing your status. You know, that's a celebration in and of itself. And so that was one of the things we were trying to accomplish. We were very strong programmers. We had Splashdown, you know, we had, what else we had? When I was president, we did this thing called Higher Learning Week, where the whole point of the week was to have interactive educational programming. When it comes to, I feel like programming, you know, obviously Brotherhood Scholarship Service or whatever fraternity you in, Brotherhood is going to be, you know, service to the community and, you know, being a scholar. You know, those are the basic pillars of every fraternity and sorority on campus too. You know, instead of not Brotherhood, it'll be Sisterhood, but, you know. So, but beyond that foundation, you know, you have to carve out your niche. And so by us doing those programming, you know, it really impacted not only the students on campus, not only us as programmers, but also the greater community. So that's why the community, you know, when during my time in the chapter, you know, we were known in the community, like people knew us, like we go to Publix or we could go to any, we go anywhere in the hood, we go to, you know, the suburbs or we go to the hood, people knew us because of the presence that we had. You know, we wearing those letters, you know, that's all that matters. That's the point of wearing the letters, you know what I'm saying? Because you in the community and people could recognize that no matter what. So, and again, I think that's something, you know, with our current BGLOs at PWIs, I think that's something that's missing, you know, especially here in Gainesville. A lot of Greek letter organizations never even been outside the 13th and 34th. And that's the problem. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
Impact is the key.
Mm-hmm. So, switching gears just a little bit, thinking back on your experiences at FSU, did you have a mentor?
I didn't have one specific mentor. No, I had several mentors. Obviously, the people who came before me in the fraternity on campus. And then when I was a newly minted Phi Beta Sigma man, I also was the president. Mm-hmm. So that was a very interesting dynamic with being a president, but also being new. And so within the Black organization tradition, if you're new, then you're treated a certain way, but they couldn't necessarily treat me a certain way because I was the president of a chapter. So everything had to run through me. I had to sign off on every little thing, especially when it came to financial issues. And, you know, so my mentors were people who did mentor me who were part of the chapter mainly were ones who were presidents before, like me. And also, I received strong mentorship from the graduate chapter, I would say. Very strong mentorship from them. And there was one particular Zeta. She's actually a Mu Epsilon Zeta, Melvina Wilson. She commented on your Facebook.
Yeah.
We go way back. Actually, I first met her because she used to work at the Student Health Center at Florida State. And she, I met her when before I was even a Phi Beta Sigma man. And she, you know, we always had a close relationship. And so she mentored me. She mentored me. I received strong mentorship from her as well. And to this day, she still mentors me whenever we get a chance to talk. Because she's gone down a path that I have went down with academics, and with teaching, and with being in the community. So that's what I would say was my main mentors were graduate chapter, fraternity brothers, brothers who came before me who were in the Mu Epsilon chapter, and Melvina Wilson, the Zeta, the Mu Epsilon Zeta.
So with that being said, I know you just mentioned going down the same path in your academic life. When I know as an undergraduate, it's kind of difficult to say when you're approaching graduation, oh, do I want to go straight into the workforce? Do I want to go into academics again? What really influenced your decision? Was it your mentors? Was it your family? Like, how did you come to the decision to go on to graduate school?
Definitely. It was, well, first of all, because I didn't go into graduate school directly out of college. Mm-hmm. I had to struggle, honestly. I worked for, well, first of all, when I first graduated from high school, I mean, from college, from Florida State, it was spring 2008. It was a height of recession. I thought since I graduated with 3 degrees, I was going to get this nice, fancy job. I didn't. So I ended up on my auntie's couch and I stayed there. I had to come back to Tampa, stay on my auntie's couch, back and forth between my mama's house and my auntie's couch. But I prefer to be on my auntie's couch because my mama didn't have cable or internet. So I was on my auntie's couch. And what happened? Oh, I was on my auntie's couch and I worked temporary jobs. I cleaned ditches or dig ditches, cleaned under boats. Me and my buddy, we would wake up 2 a.m. in the morning to get these temporary jobs at temp job agencies, like at Able Body. Mm-hmm. So I would clean out the boats, dig ditches. I would direct traffic at the fairgrounds. I would drive cars at the auction. We did all this stuff, and the most we ever made, we worked like eight, nine hour days, and we would only get like a check of $30. Because they would take away, they would give you, we made, it was like $6.25 per hour, which is nothing. Mm-hmm. Then you had to pay taxes. So you getting taxed that little old paycheck. Mm-hmm. Then you had to pay like a fee for transportation because they would bus you out to wherever site that you was doing. So I did this for a period of time and it sucked, man. It really did suck having degrees and doing that initially. But we did it and we survived. We would, after we finish, after we get our little money, they give us a little check, we go to Publix and cash it. And then we'd go to CC's Pizza and have us a little the little buffet for $3.99. Mm-hmm. And we did that all over again the next day. And so I did this for a period of time. And then finally, I got a temp job working at Citigroup in Tampa. And I was making $15 an hour. That was great. But they fired me after 3 weeks because they said that I wasn't doing a good job. Really, they just wanted to cut people down because of budgeting. And but luckily, I always kept a resume and I had a suit. And the same day I got fired, I went to my old high school, Middletown High School, gave them my resume. I had a suit. They interviewed me right then and there. And hired me right then. So the same day I got fired, I got hired, and so it was one of those experiences. It was one of those experiences that, you know, no matter what is going to happen, you know, just staying persistent is the key. So and from Middleton, I kept putting in applications through FSU's Career Center, and Strayer called me, Strayer University hired me. And then from there, from Strayer University, got my master's degree, right? And then from there, decided to go back to school. Or I was already in school. I was getting my master's degree at Strayer, but I decided to want to pursue a PhD. And FSU and UF accepted me. I chose UF because my sister was here. And so that's how I ended up here.
Okay. So after you received your PhD, what influenced your decision to either, did you leave and then come back to the University of Florida, or did you just stay?
No, after I got my PhD from University of Florida, I was offered by the University of Florida to teach African American Studies program. Obviously, I interviewed for the position. I got the position. And so I decided to stay.
Okay, so how was the atmosphere when you first started working here?
When I first started working here, when I first got here, which was in 2011 as a graduate assistant. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot more black people, for one, mm-hmm. much more. For two, there was much like the campus climate now, there was a lot of racism in the air, so to speak. 2011, can you re-ask the question?
Yeah. So the question was, how was the atmosphere when you first started working here?
Yeah, when I first got here, I was in a suit and tie, and I was walking down University Avenue, and I got called a nigger, and that was my first introduction that fall. You know, I've been was coming to Gainesville, because being in Tallahassee, Gainesville not too far, Blue and White Weekend was popping, Fist was popping, you know, so I was here regularly. So I knew what Gainesville was about, but, you know, that was my first wake-up call being here, like that first week here for fall. And, you know, and I was like, wow, I guess I shouldn't wear a suit anymore. So... And so in 2011, there was a blackface incident. You can actually look it up. They were imitating Chris Rainey and some other people. And then, so that was a big stir. And the year before I came, 2010, there was a student, an African student, who actually got shot in the face by the police.
Do you know the name?
Sharon can tell you. Okay. About it, yeah. So that was happening. And then in 2012, there was another blackface incident. And by this time, I was president of the Black Graduate Student Organization. So, you know, BGSO. And they're just, you know, my administration decided to do something about it. And so for years, the program, the African American Studies program, had been filing petitions for there to be a major in African American Studies, because we didn't even have a major at that time. Mm-hmm. You only could minor or get a certificate in African American Studies. And so once that blackface incident happened, you know, there was a town hall, and from that town hall was a consensus type group. Back then, the IBC was very strong. It was strong because it was strong because of the students. The students were less divided back then. IBC served more so as a space for meeting to discuss these types of issues. It wasn't as if the IBC staff were doing his own separate program. That wasn't what was going on back then. What was going on back then was that different student organizations would have meetings there and would have programs there. And they just kind of let everything, you know, fester a bit as far as the groups. Like, it wasn't one person leading everything. You know what I'm saying? It was like, you know, and so we used that space, and off-campus space too, to mobilize what we wanted to do in conjunction with the African American Studies program to get the major. And a lot of people didn't give us a shot, but it worked. And we got the major in 2013, approved for it. 2013, we started teaching. I started teaching for the program that summer 2013. Intro to African American Studies online. I was the first one to create an online class for African American Studies, and it's the same course I'm teaching now. Mm-hmm. So the atmosphere when I first came, there was more Black students and there was much more of a presence. I feel like certainly racism, but I feel like, you know, the students were still a little bit more tighter. The set was popping and, you know, it was just more going on for students. It was more house parties and just stuff like that, you know, just chilling, you know, people just chilled out and really bonded. It wasn't a lot of division, I would say. It was a lot of division, but people worked together a little bit more as far as in the African-American community.
If you could make a projection into like when the division may have started or what caused it, what would that kind of look like?
I would say the division started after we got the major. Student affairs they kind of went overboard with, you know, addressing certain issues. And one of the things they did was they created the Black Affairs Department. Mm-hmm. And that completely splintered the community. And I don't think that was the intention, but that was the after effect because, you know, from hearing from students and, you know, and being that I was a student at the time, so I understood what the dynamic was, because it was like, okay, all of a sudden we have a Black Affairs Department. So, you know, other organizations, specifically like Black Student Union and NAACP, you know, were wondering where would they fit in the equation. And then, you know, Black Affairs like completely taking over a lot of the student advocacy, you know, taking away the advocacy from the students and putting it in the hands of administration, which is what Student Affairs is. It's an administrative unit. You know, so that's where I feel like that was the start of further division, coupled with the enrollment of African-American students declining. So those things. And so what happens is once you keep taking away from the pot, then, you know, there's limited resources to go around. And so, you know, and then now with them taking, you know, with the BEC, we don't know with the IBC, we don't know what that's going to look like in the future when it is, you know, is it going to be a standalone campus? Is it going to be part of something else? We don't know. So I say all that to say, as far as with the division, you know, people might not want to admit it, but it started, further division started with Black Affairs Department being created, because and administration trying to funnel every single little problem of Black people, trying to funnel it as an administrative problem when it's deeper than rap. And, you know, the byproduct of that, because what happens is that a lot of staff felt, since they were in that department, they felt like they had to be the voice of students. And it's like, no, whenever anything got done on this campus, it's always the students being the voice of the students. It's always been like that, always. The IBC came into existence for that reason. Students being allowed to even come on this campus, it was because of students' voice, you know, especially students from FAMU. They would come down and protest. Us getting the major, you know, students, graduate students, and we worked with BSU and NAACP to make that happen. So it was always students at the forefront. So with Black, and I'm not blaming Black Affairs Department for everything, but I'm just saying that was part of it. Like, it was part of it. And you got to look at who's over Black Affairs. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, so if the person who's over Black Affairs don't really have the best interest of Black students on this campus, or maybe don't understand, then you know, it's going to trickle down as far as the operation of, or the apparatus of, how do you address the concerns, the apparatus of addressing. The apparatus can't just be, we're creating this department and then that's that, you know, especially if there's not really something there that previous, I mean, obviously the IBC was there previously, but, you know, I understand why it was created to basically maintain between BEC and IBC. We understand that. But the after effects of it was that it just is so for the division, just like it's so in division in that unit in general, in student affairs unit in general, that's trickled over into the communities.
I don't know if you're comfortable answering this on tape. You can say no if that's if you don't want to answer it. But when you say the person who's over Black Affairs, do you mean a specific position?
I think Student Affairs is over Black Affairs. So that's what I mean.
Okay. On the topic of student enrollment, you keep mentioning that in some of your answers. I personally have been doing some research into Black student enrollment, retention, and graduation rates for University of Florida. So as a Black faculty member, do you have any opinions on how, like, what can increase specifically Black undergraduate student retention?
Retention specifically can be increased with more programs that are specifically targeted towards African-American students. So, for example, if you had a separate, you know, full-time tutors, full-time lab resources, especially for our STEM students, I think that could go a long way in retaining students. I think if you had visible Black markers on campus, like maybe a statue of Virgil Hawkins, maybe a building, a visible building, not just something that's off to the side, but a visible building on campus that was named after, you know, some other prominent Black contributors to the history, you know, University of Florida. I think those types of things, definitely scholarships, more, because a lot of times students leave because, you know, it's the money, really. And so we have some programs, but a lot of those programs aren't geared specifically towards African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not targeted. So I think those things can go a long way in retaining and just providing an atmosphere of acceptance. You know, I had a young lady in here that came in earlier. You know, she, you know, a white female student. And she didn't know who Virgil Hawkins was. I feel like that's a problem. If all of our students should know who Virgil, every student, Black, white, Hispanic, every student should know who Virgil Hawkins is. And so it's like, well, how do you do that? You do that orientation, preview, the good life, first year Florida. It's so many entry points and ways you can work that in into students knowing about Virgil Hawkins. And I think that's the issue. I think not knowing that type of history, not knowing that how FAMU and University of Florida is tied at the hip,
mm-hmm.
With respect to land grant institutional funding and how the state legislature for years diverted the funds, actually for almost 60 years, diverted funds meant for FAMU, diverted it to University of Florida, you know, up until 1966, you know, that's an issue. Like, students should know that. And, you know, because knowledge goes a long way in helping the climate, you mm-hmm. know. And so if students aren't aware of these types of things, you know, they're not going to go out of way to try to find it out. That's going to further contribute to their ignorance, and relying on their ignorance whenever they're mad at something or they, you know. So I think that's important.
So I don't know if you caught on, but one of the major themes of this conversation has been programming. So have you as a Black faculty member implemented any programs that leaves a lasting impact on undergraduate students?
Yes. One program I put together this past fall was the Tupac Shakur Symposium. And so I got a lot of good feedback. In fact, students overwhelmingly liked that program that they decided to, some decided to go ahead and take a course in African American Studies and have eventually declared a major. So I think that's left a lasting impact. And what I'm trying to do in the community, I teach a course called Mentoring At-Risk Youth, in which I make our students go into the community and mentor students, mentor people or children in the after-school programs, in the summer programs, in the community centers. So I think those type of programs that I've done, it is more, but I'm just mentioning those two, have left an impact on campus and in the community, and you know, just furthers my base from my experience, in high school, my experience at Florida State. You know, it just goes along with it, you know, as far as what I'm about and what my foundation is.
Okay, so are you familiar with the Black Student Affairs Task Force?
Yes.
Okay, so being familiar with it, if you could make a recommendation that would improve the experiences of Black students here at UF, what would that recommendation be? Like, if I don't know if you know the specific ones or if you can add to what was in the task force, like what should we focus on to make retention here or even enrollment here a little bit better?
I think the Black Student Task Force has to make a decision on what, okay, if they decide on what's important, the Black Student Task Force has to make a decision on whether they're going to deal with student affairs or whether they're going to deal with the specific units that handle the issues that they're talking about. Because you could complain all day long to these student affairs administrators, but a lot of times they don't have the power to do the things that you want to be done. Like us becoming a department that has nothing to do with student affairs. You know what I'm saying? That's the deans, you know, in a specific college, you know. And so, but students keep confusing, you know, that every little problem we have to go to student affairs. No, you don't. You can form your own committee and you can go to the individual units that handle. So if you want more enrollment at the University of Florida, you should be meeting with the admissions, the president of admissions department. You shouldn't be meeting with student affairs. They can't do anything about that. You know, if you want, you know, retention, you should be making sure that you're keeping in close in contact with the people who deal with retention on campus. Not only the I guess the AIM program is sort of the apparatus for it, but who gives money? What department is AIM up under? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's who you, that's, these are the thing, the people, but because for so long, Black Affairs has, you know, kind of conditioned us to believe, oh, just tell student affairs and then everything will be okay. No, it's not, everything is not going to be okay because they can't affect the, what you want to be affected. You know, administrators can go to another, maybe the ideas of administrator go to another administrator and then try to get it done that way. That's never worked in the history of this school. Never. It's always been direct student contact with the people who make the decisions directly. And so I think that's what the Student Affairs Task Force, I think if I had to make a recommendation, I think the Student Affairs Task Force, the Black Student Task Force. That's, am I saying it right?
Yeah, it's the Black Student Affairs Task Force.
Black Student Affairs Task Force should function more as an umbrella to manage these different initiatives and making sure that whatever student groups or group of students or student want to address these specific issues, to connect these, to connect people together to get it done. And maybe if Black Affairs want to make a decision to focus on something specifically, okay, meet with that specific unit to get it done. Stop meeting with, I don't want to say stop meeting, but don't have the idea, at least, that if you just tell this specific administrator in student affairs, then everything is going to be okay. Everything's not going to be okay. In fact, that could be exacerbating the problem.
Okay, we're almost at the end.
Yeah, it's fine.
But as a faculty member belonging to the African American Studies program, what benefit do you think that it offers for Black students?
As far as the program?
Yeah.
Oh, for one, it offers a more stable, safe space because we don't have ulterior motives. We want to see the students succeed academically, and part of succeeding academically is having a good sense of well-being. So obviously we're interested in your well-being too. Our director, Dr. Austin, is awesome. You know, there's no ulterior motives with her or any of us. You know, like I said, we just want to make sure that the students succeed, get a good education, and be productive members of society. And that's the key, you know, that's the key, because with some of these other units, you know, that's not the main objective. The main objective is to advance their, whatever their specific agenda is, whether it's hidden or out in front. And that's not what we're about here at the African American Studies program. And, you know, we don't have an overall agenda. Our overall agenda is to see our students succeed. And we can only do that with, obviously, the right resources. You know, how great would it be if students had their own, or if students were able to, you know, meet in a space separate from student affairs? That's invaluable. You know what I'm saying? How great would that be? And so, you know, that's one of our, one of the things that, what, and this is, these are things that students regularly communicate to us. And so, you know, so being in African American studies, you know, the benefits, I would say, is to have a separate, or to have an additional, I would say, option for an alternative option for students to come and grow and be nurtured. And, you know, I hate using the word safe space, but to have an area in which, you know, they don't have to worry about being spied upon or, you know, microaggression from other administrators or student groups. And so that's the advantage of AFA.
So when you say that this is a safe space, or not a safe space, but that's the only word they can describe
right,
it.
Right.
But
it's a zone.
A zone, a safe zone. How exactly is that possible? Like, do they come in this office, or like, is it in the classroom? How is that zone created?
Definitely in the classroom, and being able to learn intellectually, not being told, you know, how to handle a situation, but to actually, you know, learn something on the sociological aspect and impact of African Americans, of your culture, which is part of the celebration of the culture. And anytime our students want to do programming, we never say no to our students. For what? You know what I'm saying? Like, you want to do some program? Okay, fine, let's do some programming. Because we need to do what's in the best interest of promoting the culture, you know. And so I think that's what I would say is the advantage as far as African Americans studies and, you know, this zone we have created. We've created an intellectual zone. And, you know, the next step is to have a physical, more of a bigger physical zone, obviously, with the amount of students that we've been educating.
If you could give one word that describes your experience here at the University of Florida from start to, well, start to present, what would that word be?
From start to present?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I would say interesting. I mean, when I first got here in 2011, I didn't even have funding initially.
Mm-hmm.
But I never took that long. And that's because the people who I've made personal connections with have always looked out for me.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Austin being one of them. So the people have made it interesting. You know, there are some people who don't have my best interests at heart, and that's fine. I mean, that's life.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I was president of the Black Graduate Student Organization. That made it very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to see the different processes on campus, how it works, how student government works, how access works, how, you know, all these perfunctory organizations or units on campus function, you know, in their interaction with students. You know, it's been very interesting, but it's been very good. It's been very good for the most part. Very good.
So. Is there anything that you wish I would have asked?
I think we've been very thorough, and I think whatever I wish you would ask, I think I addressed it in my soliloquies anyway.
So. Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking your time out of your day to talk with me a little bit about the issues that we have on campus. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.